by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Our next speaker is Vince Palomera, and he's from Pittsburgh area. He has some very interesting studies that he's done over a number of years. Vince Palomera, welcome to the conference, the JFK Assassination Conference in Dallas, Texas. Arlington is the location. Welcome to our conference.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for everybody attending, and glad to be here in some form or fashion.
Vince, tell our conference attendees a little bit about your background and so forth, education, I think sociology and so forth, and let them know some of your background, education and so forth.
Okay, yeah, I'm 48 years old, and at the tender age of 12, believe it or not, when I was in middle school, we're talking 1978, is when I got deeply into President Kennedy's, both his life and his tragic death, his assassination. And it was spurred on, of all things, from a book called 4 Days, and it was an Associated Press book. There's a picture of Secret Service agent Clint Hill by the presidential limousine at Love Field at Dallas Airport. And I think the reason why I was always gravitated towards the Secret Service was because I also had an interest in the fictional show on the Secret Service called The Wild Wild West, although that took place in the 19th century, and again, it was fictional. I'm a graduate of Duquesne University, major in sociology. Again, I'm a Pittsburgh native. I've been in the banking industry for 20-plus years. I've contributed in some form or fashion to over 100 other authors' books, and I've been at other conferences and whatnot. I'm proud to be at this one. Thank you very much. And all these years leading from that tender age of 12 up to the present, all points in between, I've been fascinated with the Secret Service. And as Robert Groden was famous saying, maybe that's why they call the Secret Service a secret. I never really thought twice about them. And I noticed that, you know, especially earlier on, up to like the late 80s, early 90s, I noticed that from a lot of other people that they just didn't really look too far and wide at the Secret Service. I mean, everybody, you know, understandably so, looks at the CIA, looks at J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, you know, and go into the mafia, anti-Castro Cubans, but at least up to like a point in the late 80s, early 90s, the Secret Service got a lot of short shrift, just little topics here and there, but not the wide span. And it was, and again, this is a thumbnail sketch in the interest of time, but in 1991, I was, 24 going on 25, I spoke at a conference in Vernonia, New York. It was the Third Decade Conference. Everybody knows Jerry Rose. And there was about 60 researchers there. It was before the JFK movie, all the hoopla surrounding that. And there was people in the audience who were old enough to be my father and even in some cases my grandfather. And they were impressed with the paper I gave at the time. It was largely secondary sources at that point. I didn't speak to one agent at that point. But they spurred me on. They were like, you're really onto something. I never really, like Bob Cutler was one of the authors over there. I never really looked at the Secret Service before. George Michael Ivica, who's also passed away, said the same thing. You know, you really have to plow forward with this. You're onto something. And that was my inspiration to actually contact these former agents. And again, this is before the internet really kicked in. I mean, there was message bulletin boards, but for all intents and purposes, there was no internet that I knew of. It was all directory assistance, newspaper archives, the morgue of, you know, newspapers, and a lot of luck and hunches and whatnot to find these gentlemen. They lived in all parts of the country. You know, a decent amount lived in Florida and the greater Washington, D.C. area, but a lot of it was just through happenstance and networking. And one after another, these former Secret Service agents that protected President Kennedy were telling me things that went against official history. And the official history, other than Oswald acting alone, there's no conspiracy, that's the official history, although we know the House Select Committee came out with a different verdict saying there was a probable conspiracy, but I digress at the moment. The official hoopla, the official myth is that President Kennedy was difficult to protect, had somehow ordered the agents away from his limousine and some other things, but the motorcycles, the bubble top, didn't want them. And somehow, directly or indirectly, there's a hint that he kind of had it coming, whether you believe Oswald acted alone or there was a grand conspiracy, that, well, you know, it's a shame that President Kennedy, he didn't want these things done. And I found out through my interviews, this is not true. The onus falls back on the Secret Service. And it was all just by happenstance. September 27th, 1992 is a date that will live in infamy with me, you know, borrowing a phrase from FDR talking about Pearl Harbor Day. You know, and I know with David Lifton, it's when he found the Seibert O'Neill report about the autopsy and the alleged surgery of the head area. With me, it was September 27th, 1992. I spoke to the head of the White House detail, Gerald Behn, and it's spelled B-E-H-N. He died 7 months later of cancer. Luckily, he consented to being audio taped and an old cassette. And luckily, some portions survived and whatnot, and some other agents I spoke to, I taped. But September 27th, he told me, amazingly, shockingly, I don't remember Kennedy ever saying anything about not having the agents on the back of the car. And again, I don't remember the agents, him ever telling the agents not to be at the back of the car. If you look at the newsreel pictures, you'll see the agents on there from time to time. When he told me that, I was totally shocked. I believe William Manchester's death of a president. I believe Jim Bishop spoke the day Kennedy was shot and other things. I took it almost, I wouldn't say gospel, but I tended to believe that even the Secret Service had failings, shortcomings, that, well, part of the onus does fall on the president at that time. When the head of the White House detail, I guess that we still call it the General Pat, the General MacArthur, the Secret Service, so to speak, is telling you this, I was just totally blown away. But at the same time, I was being a devil's advocate. I always have a part of my brain that says, wait a minute, you have to get corroboration for this when the smoke clears. I mean, it is amazing. The number one agent is telling you President Kennedy never ordered the agents off the car, and this is not true. But you got to get corroboration, because somebody might say, well, he's senile. Well, he was very lucid, very intelligent, very witty. And one after another, again, these guys lived all parts of the country. I'm a stranger on the phone. I'm a stranger in a letter, unsolicited letter and whatnot. And they're all telling me President Kennedy never ordered us off the car, never ordered us to do anything. Was a very nice man, very cooperative. And the $64 million question is, wait a minute now. The Warren Commission, in their report and other reports after and other books, lay the blame tacitly at the president for not having this protection there. And now you're telling me it's not true, former agents. Well, then why are you presenting the mythology back in 63, 64 that it was true? And that was the journey of my book. My book's called Survivor's Guilt, The Secret Service, and the Failure to Protect President Kennedy. And it took 20-plus years to write and research. And it's the culmination of all these many interviews with former Secret Service agents and related sundry people on the know, White House aides, former White House photographers, people that were on these many motorcades of President Kennedy and, for that matter, other presidents before and after, and comparing the official record, going through many thousands, hundreds of thousands of pages of documents, over-the-counter books, you name it, and to compare the official record, films and photos. And that's the fruits of my labor. If you want, we'll get into more specifics from here, but that's a thumbnail sketch of my background and why a book was written. If Gerald Behn and some of these agents would have told me something different, even if they were lying through their teeth, I don't think there would have been a book. If they would have told me, oh, President Kennedy didn't want us on the car, oh, that's true, that is true, probably maybe would have looked elsewhere and never would have wrote a book, or maybe nothing would have ever came of my research. But it was because of this happenstance of these gentlemen telling me these things and not even realizing some of these guys believe there was a conspiracy, but the majority did not. So again, that actually lends even more credibility, for lack of a way of putting it, because here they are, a stranger on the phone, unsolicited, and they're telling me these things, not even realizing the weight of what they're saying, the gravity of the circumstances, because it's like, wait a minute now. You're saying something diametrically opposed to this official mythology, something you still deal with to this day. In fact, it still makes me want to pull up my hair. Every once in a while, you'll see some television program, and the narrator will blame President Kennedy for the agents not being here. He wanted the people to see him and all this this total nonsense, total propaganda. And again,
Vince, you got on to this because on motorcades, and the Secret Service has certain procedures specifically to cover and to provide security for motorcades, right?
Correct.
And this is where you got onto this thing. You begin to see there weren't enough agents on either side of the, and don't they walk along there in some cases on some motorcades in the past?
Oh, yeah, yeah, no doubt. And what it was, again, comparing films and photos and the official record, release Secret Service, final survey reports of various trips. Then and now, advance teams go to cities, whatever the president, whether it's President Kennedy or any other president, visits the city. They go in advance, and they work with the local authorities, military, police, whatnot. And they canvass motorcade routes. They advise on security and details of men and so on and so forth. And here again, that's why nothing's black and white in this case. While it is certainly true, and I always take pains to tell people this, no, agents were not always on the back of the car. He didn't always have the bubble top. But, and this is, you can underline this in your mind at least, he did have tremendous security in other respects that might not appear in a still photograph or an angle of a film and whatnot. And what that is one of my other major discoveries is before Dallas, not just as a reaction to the assassination, which many people, myself included, believe for many years, building rooftops were guarded by either police, agents, military, or some combination of all the above, as well as plainclothes policemen in good numbers being in the actual crowds themselves working in conjunction with a short staff Secret Service. Back then, there were only 300, 350 agents in the entire country. So there's no doubt that they were shorthanded to a point. That's how the onus fell on the military lining the parade routes, watching the crowd. Police lining the parade and watching the crowd. So even if the agents weren't always in the back of the car, President Kennedy was not in the equation. President Kennedy never ordered the agents off the car. That's a myth. That was a myth. It was started because they realized, wait a minute, we dropped the ball in Dallas. Heads are going to roll. We're going to lose the agency. We might get into criminal prosecutions here. We might get into congressional hearings, loss of pensions, loss of reputations, et cetera. So, that, yeah, President Kennedy's conveniently dead. He can't defend himself. It sounds good. Hey, you know, he had this coming. I Have a Rendezvous with Death was his favorite poem. Meantime, we all have a rendezvous with death. None of us are immortal here. But to get back on point here, what, again, I want people to stress this. Yes, if you're looking at a still photo or even like a clip of a motorcade, you may or may not see agents on the back of the car. But again, how that was handled is you had local police and or agents and or the military lining the streets facing the crowd. You had plainclothes men in good number intermingled with the crowds to watch. And again, you had the building rooftops guarded. And now people might be saying, wow, that's a heavy charge. Building rooftops are guarded? Where's your proof of this? My proof is tremendous on this point. It's multiple. We have Chief Inspector Michael Tarina. Chief Inspector Michael Tarina of the Secret Service wrote the Secret Service manual. If there's anybody else in the world that would know proper Secret Service procedures, I think that Chief Inspector Michael Tarina, who was a decades-long veteran of the Secret Service at that time, well, he contributed, of all things, a book for young adults called What Does a Secret Service Agent Do? That came out the year before the assassination. And it matter-of-factly says in the book that whenever the president is in a motorcade, agents or police guard the rooftops until his procession passes. Now, that was tremendous. I spoke to the gentleman who's since passed away about 10 years ago, and he confirmed that. He didn't want to go into more details, but, you know, he confirmed that what was in that book was true. I said to myself, well, that's tremendous. Again, you've got to give corroboration. Lo and behold, the corroboration was falling out of the woodwork. I go through newspaper archives. JFK visits Milwaukee. Police are guarding the rooftops, they say. He goes to Nashville, the same thing. Chicago, the same thing. France, the same thing. Ireland, Germany, the list goes on. I even saw a couple still photos where there's actually policemen on the actual rooftops. And let me clarify this again for your audience. I'm not saying every single rooftop. Multi-story buildings were guarded. How they handled single-story buildings, like they're going through a suburban area, the motorcade would be going at a faster rate of speed, and with the policemen or military lining the street or the plainclothesmen being in the crowds, that would be the buffer. Just like agents weren't always in the back of the car, well, when they were going past like a neighborhood that only had like the one-story buildings, the common houses, you see ranch homes and whatnot, those weren't guarded on the rooftops. They had the faster procession, and they had the eyes and ears on the streets watching the crowds and the windows and whatnot. But when they went through downtown areas, yes, building rooftops, windows were guarded. And again, Tampa, Florida, the major trip before Texas, just 4 short days before, this was President Kennedy's longest motorcade route. It's a fact. Look it up. Dallas, in comparison, was a much shorter motorcade. Yet the longest motorcade JFK ever took domestically all multi-story buildings regarded. Not only is that in the Secret Service report printed in my book. This is all in my book, by the way. It's heavily documented. I actually have photographs of documents and photos that demonstrate these things, newspaper articles and whatnot. But Gerald Blaine, a former agent who came out with the book The Kennedy Detail, we'll get into that in a moment. Well, he's the author of this final survey report, this official Secret Service report, and he even says, matter-of-factly, the building rooftops were guarded by the sheriff's department as the procession passed. This is the longest motorcade, so your audience is going to think to yourself, wait a minute now. 4 days before, the major trip before in Florida, they're guarding building rooftops, and I already told you there's a definite precedent for this. We've got Michael Trina, who wrote the Secret Service manuals, even confirming this, in a book for the whole world to read the year before it comes out. It's a book that's in middle schools and even like higher grade schools are getting this book. It's like a textbook. It says this, and he contributed to it. Okay, but yet he comes to Dallas, a city he's warned by Senator Fulbright, Pierre Salinger, other people not go. In fact, JFK even said, we're heading to nut country right now. Talking about Dallas, yeah, the right-wing atmosphere, the wanted for treason, and yet they can't watch building rooftops there. Even for those sole people out there that somehow, in their twisted mind, think Oswald acted alone or acted at all, anyone would have been on the rooftops would have saw that. And another thing I discovered amazingly is former Secret Service Chief Huey Bauman, he was Kennedy's first Secret Service Chief, ironically made the chief November 22nd, 1948. You can read my book about more about him. He came out with a major interview about a week after the assassination. Said, there was definitely a slip up there. Buildings were normally secured on motorcades, not just in Washington, D.C., but it was standard protocol in other cities. We would have the rooftops, and we would get together with the building superintendents. Sound familiar? Roy Truby, building superintendent of Texas School Book Depository. Even Thomas Kelly, inspector, testified before the Hoslet Committee 15 years later and admitted, warehouses. We would try to, make sure those were guarded. Hello, the book depository is a warehouse. It's just amazing. So, again, official mythology. Most people think, and this is what the average person thinks out there. It doesn't know any better. Not so much the research community. They've been educated, but the average person walk around. Most people believe there's a conspiracy, but the same token, if they get into the nuts and bolts of his protection, they say, well, the protection was awful, but that was 1963, and, well, I heard that Kennedy didn't want that protection. It's not true. 1963 standards were good. They're not as good as they are today. I'm not going to say they're not. Today is like science fiction what they could do now. But there's a reason why presidents lived for decades and Kennedy was alive for the 3 years before. It's not just luck and happenstance. They watched building rooftops. They moved at a faster procession. They had good motorcycle formations. Sometimes he had a partial bubble top or a full bubble top. I have at least 20 instances where JFK's smiling in hot weather, no rain, he has the bubble top on. We'll get into that in a moment. But again, all these things. So you can't just do the gotcha game. That's why I've been trying to scold some people that play devil's advocate. Hey, it's usually just people that believe Oswald acted alone. You got to deal with. And so you got to look at the totality of the evidence, and you got to say to yourself, wait a minute now. In the average motorcade, if agents were there or not, had nothing to do with Kennedy. If the agents weren't physically by the car, they were going at a faster rate of speed with the buildings watched. The motorcycles were in good numbers surrounding the car. They blamed it on Kennedy that allegedly he didn't want the motorcycles by the car. Yet in the other prior Texas stops in San Antonio, Houston, and Fort Worth that morning, there's motorcycles all around the car and in good number. In fact, I spoke to a gentleman, Russell Gruber. He was a motorcycle officer in Tampa, Florida, on that motorcade I talked about. He confirmed that all multi-story buildings were heavily guarded. And the reason why there were no agents on the back of the car at the very end of that trip, because, by the way, in Florida, agents were on the back of the car for most of that long motorcade. So a much longer motorcade, agents were on the back of the car, and they're going at a faster rate of speed. I said, well, wait a minute. I saw some clips, Mr. Gruber, where at the very end of the motorcade, why weren't agents on there? Did JFK order them off? No. The reason why they weren't there is the motorcade was over for the public, and we were going at a much higher rate of speed, and that was on the highway path to all the smaller homes. We're out of the downtown district and whatnot. So, again, that's why I always tell people to do primary research. Don't rely on secondary sources. Do your own thinking, because some people might look at one still photo and go, aha, I don't see agents on the back of the car. Explain yourself, and there's your explanation. 90% of that motorcade, they were there. They weren't there for the 10% at the end because they were going at a faster rate of speed. And there's, you had the military and the police lining the street facing the crowd, and again, you had the intermingling of the officers throughout the crowds. So very clever how they did things back then to compensate for the lack of actual number of agents like you have now. 300 agents. I think 300 agents in the entire country back then, 350. Now, that good number would probably be on a typical presidential motorcade today, and it'd be all throughout the crowds and whatnot, and because you know better manpower. But again, I tell the context of the time, 1963, Kennedy should have lived, and this was blamed on him. But if you want, I can go into even more nuts and bolts, but just we'll stop there for a moment and be.
You know, L. Fletcher Prouty, didn't he bring up the point about the military was called off, or there was an error in commanding one of the units in there, and there was a mix-up? What did that have to do with it?
Yes, yeah. In fact, I go into my book about that. In fact, chapter 6 and 7, in particular chapter 6, where I go into a litany of specifics, all documented. Colonel Fletcher Prouty has been vindicated. I remember when the gentleman passed away, some people were trying to claim there's no Secret Service manual. It is a landslide. There's definitely a Secret Service manual. Colonel Fletcher Prouty knew what he was talking about. It wasn't made up. There's no doubt. I spoke to the gentleman who wrote the Secret Service manual, Chief Michael Tarina. Well, Fletcher Prouty espoused that the 112th Military Intelligence Unit was told to stand down the night before and over the protest of the unit commander. It turns out that is true. That's not made up. It turns out in the late 1990s, we're only talking like 15 years ago, because the Assassination Records Review Board, ARRB, they released many documents, like a couple million to be exact, and they released the Secret Service shift reports for the Texas trip. The Secret Service shift reports that the Secret Service didn't destroy. I don't want to get on a tangent. I want to answer you directly about Fletcher Prouty, but just for a moment here, it's a good diversion. Yeah, the Secret Service is the only agency, not the FBI, not the CIA, no one else destroyed records. They did it on purpose. January 1995, after they were asked, they shredded a whole bunch of survey reports for President Kennedy's trips in the late summer and fall of 63, and only kept a few, I guess, because they were caught and they had to, you know, submit, because I think they didn't want the comparison. They didn't want people like me to say, wait a minute. I mean, when he went to Philadelphia, he had agents on the back of the car. He had the rooftops guarded. So only a few survived the shredder. But now to answer you succinctly about San Antonio the day before, these reports confirm there were 40 members of the 112th Military Intelligence Unit were guarding the motorcade. You had a helicopter along the parade route. You had multi-story building rooftops guarded, okay, and you had the Trentis motorcycle formation that was not there in Dallas. So all I'll say about this is the documents don't explicitly say there was a stand-down, but isn't it amazing that there was 40 members of the 112th Military Intelligence Unit there in San Antonio, and you got the helicopter and whatnot. The next day, they're not officially there, but as the little conundrum, and it's like details in Chapter 2 of my book, that you had one member, James Powell, who took one of the famous photographs of the book depository. He tries to make it almost sound like he was there off duty as a civilian, even though he was, you know, a member of the 112th Military Intelligence Unit. He took, you know, a picture of the depository after the shots were fired, and he was there. And now if you're playing devil's advocate, you might say to yourself, wait a minute now. They're called down. You had this member of the military intelligence was there. What was he doing? And part of my chapter two is I think he was there along with several other people in the agency that were covertly monitoring threats to the president's life. Oh, yeah, they knew. It had nothing to do with Oswald. This was a moving crowd. There were threats, plural, to President Kennedy. And you had a couple members of the Secret Service who were on trips before and during the Texas trip. They were actively, covertly monitoring this threat. That's what chapter two of my book is. And lo and behold, President Kennedy's killed. And that's where you get into the whole rigmarole about all those many witnesses that rushed to the grassy knoll. Many of those witnesses shot came from the front, and they run into quote-unquote Secret Service agents, and one Joe Marshall Smith police officer drew his gun, said, I felt silly, but in hindsight, he looked like an auto mechanic, his hands were all dirty and whatnot. I posit that rather than being a phony guy, a goblin, a member of the CIA, I believe it was a real Secret Service agent. It could have been a member of either the White House detail from another part of the trip. It could have been a member of the Dallas office, another field office. I believe it could have actually been a real Secret Service agent. It was either there for sinister purposes, or at the very least, he was there as part of the protection or to monitor threats. And they didn't want to officially admit that, because you imagine how bad it looks. The Secret Service in 1963 was already in trouble as it is. They lost the president, and they had the drinking incident the night before with nine members of the agency were at drinking, including four guys in the FOB car and Clint Hill being one of them. Well, now, if it came out that you had agents officially stationed around the grassy knoll area, and on top of that, might have even been monitoring threats, and they failed, heads would have rolled. There would have been congressional hearings, maybe criminal procedures, civil procedures, loss of pension, loss of reputation. And in fact, FBI, J. Edgar Hoover was chomping at the bit for years. As President Truman said, J. Edgar Hoover would give his eye teeth to take over the agency. It was like an open secret. There was FBI Secret Service feuding, where there was a perfect opportunity for the FBI to take the protective functions away and just have the Secret Service chase counterfeiters, which is something they did since 1865 to the present. So there you go. And I think that's why James Powell was there. I think he was there as vacationer, as some guy that's off duty. I think he was part of something that was covert. So in answer to your question, I think Fletcher Proddy from my book has been vindicated. There's no hyperbole. There's no exaggeration, as some people thought. I think he's been definitely corroborated in many respects, as well as can be corroborated decades later. And, you know, maybe not an actual overt something in paper saying they stood down. But then again, you had the San Antonio report came out in 1998, 1999, showing these officers were there. Why weren't they there the next day, hypothetically speaking? And again, get into like the motorcycles and the last minute changes there and the last minute changes of the press photographers being in front of the limousine. Normally there was a flatbed truck, sometimes multiple flatbed trucks in front of the presidential limousine. You wouldn't need amateurs like Orville Nix, Abraham Zapruder, Marie Muchmore, et cetera. God bless them. You know, nothing against them, but they're amateurs. You would have had professional still and motion photographers traveling with the president feet away in front, as you can see countless times in other trips. It's another one of the major discoveries of my book, that this was normal. They had it on Florida. They had it on other stops, many stops before. In fact, you even see the famous footage from Germany, Ireland, domestic stops. You say, so wait a minute, the perspective's in front of the limousine. Eureka. You can actually see sometimes the hands and the gentleman on the – they actually show the flatbed truck sometimes from the other angle, but you can tell that on a flatbed truck is out of nowhere. You'll see a hand. You'll see multiple people's heads in the way because they're filming the flatbed trucks. You wouldn't have needed all those amateurs, and that was called away at the last minute. Tom Dillard said that it was canceled at the last minute. We were put in Chevrolet convertibles that took us totally out of the picture. And I just wanted to just ask your audience, when does coincidence stop and conspiracy begin, or at least tremendous gross negligence? Well, what's the odds of all this happening? That, you know, everybody talks about the day Lincoln was shot, his guard, there were no Secret Service agents then, but John Parker went out and got a drink, and then, you know, John Wilkes Booth comes in and kills him. Well, think about this. We're supposed to believe that a man in a building shot a man in a car, and that's it, and another lone nut allegedly shot the other lone nut. But at the same time, this is all happening. You have President Kennedy, for the first time, ordering agents off the car. There's no evidence that he ever did this before. It turns out not to be true anyway. But supposedly, first time, hey, agents, get off the back of my car. I don't want you there. I didn't mind you there in the longest motorcade ever. This is a much shorter motorcade in a dangerous city. I don't want you to be there. He never ordered the bubble top off. In 20 other stops I've seen, he had the bubble top on, but now he supposedly orders it off. It's not true. Sam Kinney, the driver of the fob car, adamantly told me on three different occasions he was solely responsible, Sam Kinney was, for the removal of the bubble top. Had nothing to do with Kennedy whatsoever. Motorcycles were in good formation all around the car. This was normal on many other stops, including just the Texas stop, let alone 1961, 62, 63. I investigated all JFK's motorcades, every single one. It's only a finite number of motorcades, too. It wasn't like he went on 100 motorcades a month. We're only talking a finite number between 61 and 63. When I mentioned about the bubble top, 20 stops might not sound like a lot, but that's still about a third of his motorcades at a bubble top. Okay. Well, then supposedly he doesn't want the motorcycles beside the car in Dallas. That's stripped away. Again, the building rooftops were normally guarded. That's stripped away. Police normally lined the motorcade ride in good number and faced the crowd. Very few were there in Dealey Plaza, and they weren't watching the crowds. There was no military there. The car normally moved at good speed. It was crawling, and we know about Bill Greer, the driver of the limousine. He turned around not once but twice, had his foot on the brake, disobeyed a direct order from Roy Kellerman sitting next to him saying, get out of line, we've been hit. Roy Kellerman even told William Manchester that Greer then looked in the back of the car. Maybe he didn't believe me. So even Roy Kellerman was, like, scratching his head about what Bill Greer did. Even people like lone nutters like Gerald Posner and Bill Yossi, critical of the Secret Service, said that Bill Greer would have hit the gas. Kennedy lives. There you go. And it gets even stranger about Bill Greer. Bill Greer passed away in 1985. I spoke to his son Richard in 1991. A total stranger on the phone, calling for the first time, and we had a nice little conversation. Then I asked him, what did your father think of President Kennedy? The line got silent. I thought he hung up on me. I said, sir? Yeah, I'm still here. So I went to another question because I was really unnerved. I went back to what did your father think of President Kennedy? He said, well, we're Methodists, and JFK was Catholic. It turns out Bill Greer was born and raised in County Tyrone, Ireland. And as we know, for centuries, Protestants and Catholics, religious wars, people have been maimed and killed. So rather than telling me, even if it was a lie, oh, he adored him and JFK adored him, it was a love fest, he tells a stranger on the phone after not saying anything, well, we're Methodists, JFK was Catholic. Think about that when you think about the inaction on Elm Street. And also think about this. There was at least, we know of, 4 to 6 agents, probably more than that, who were angry, angry at President Kennedy for his private life. There's no doubt about it. Seymour Hersh, some people have tried to say that, oh, that's BS about Seymour Hersh. The thing about Seymour Hersh's book, The Dark Side of Camelot, where he interviewed 4 agents, one of them being on the FOB car, they were viscerally angry about President Kennedy and said, you know, this is the President of the United States. I don't think it's the way the President of the United States should act. They should be gallivanting around with hookers and prostitutes. And what do they think of us? These guys went on camera on ABC and said the same thing for a nationwide audience. It became a home video. One of them is Tim McIntyre, who wrote on the FOB car. Emery Roberts, one of my other Secret Service suspects, I have 3 of them, Bill Greer, drove a limousine, Emery Roberts, who drove a FOB car, and Floyd Boring, who was in charge of planning the text trip for the Secret Service standpoint. We'll get to that in a second. Well, Emery Roberts, although he died in 1973, Bill McIntyre, speaking for him, he said that Emery Roberts was very concerned about President Kennedy's private life. I'm paraphrasing, but this is definitely the gist. You can see my book and Seymour Hersh's. He said he talked about it a lot, Emery did, about President Kennedy. He said, what happens if one of those women around there and they're to hurt him, whatnot, and what's we doing? And don't tell your wife about this. He was very concerned. You might say, okay, well, that could go either way. But then Bill McIntyre was angry at President Kennedy. Where did he get this anger from? He just joined the White House detail in the fall of 63. Emory Roberts was there at the very beginning. He was there since the Truman days. So where did this green rookie learn this from? He had to learn this anger from Emory Roberts, because he was barely on the detail when Kennedy was killed. But the bottom line is Tim McIntyre is going on national TV and saying, yeah, prostitution, that's illegal. When you have a procurer, the procurer being Kennedy, and prostitutes, you're asking yourself, well, what do these guys think of us? That's a pretty alarming thing, feeling to have. You're supposed to protect the man. Emory Roberts, not only does he recall 2 agents at Love Field, Henry Ripka and Don Lawton. See, I name names and produce evidence. I'm not in the goblins on the grassy knoll. This is all documented. I have the evidence, and I name names, and I'm not bashful about it. Henry Roberts, not only does he recall 2 agents at Love Field, Don Lawton and Henry Ripka, when the shooting begins, he orders the men not to move. I got that from Sam Kinney, who was a foot away from him in the FOB car. Sam tried to defend his actions. Whoa, he was worried about the car swerving, and maybe I would run over one of the men. These men were sworn to protect the president. You don't do that. I even spoke to a current agent who told me that doesn't wash. You're there to lunge forward and protect the president. Your safety be damned. You're there to protect the man. That is so lame. And he's trying to cover Raymond Ross. Well, he did order us not to move, but he was probably worried about the safety of these guys maybe getting run over if they lunge forward. It's ridiculous. But it gets even worse for Emory Roberts. You might say, okay, that's pretty bad, but that's it about Emory Roberts, right? No. You might say, who benefited? Emory Roberts, you could argue, benefited the most. He, not only did he immediately usurp the authority of Roy Kellerman, the nominal agent in charge, even though he was a third stringer in Dallas, he goes on to be appointment secretary for Lyndon Johnson while he's still a Secret Service agent. This is unprecedented. I talked to other agents. They said this never happened. It shouldn't happen. The Secret Service is an apolitical agency. They don't care if you're Democrat. They don't care if you're Republican. They don't care if you're a crackpot. They're there to guard the office of the presidency. They don't care if they hate your guts or like you. They're not there for that. They have a job to do. There's a federal law that's there to protect the president. This guy should not have been appointment secretary at the same time he's an agent. These reports, again, it's in my book. It's all documented. It's not like my theories and you have to take my word for it. It's all documented. I got the newspaper articles. It's all there. It's there in black and white, but people weren't digging for this stuff. In 1965, the press was wondering, and it's in the articles reprinted in my book, wait a minute, why is Emory Roberts' agent at the desk that used to belong to Dave Powers, Dave Powers being JFK's best friend who rode in that same follow-up car, he's a White House aide, why is he at Dave Powers' old desk and he's greeting the British or the Japanese prime minister? And George Reedy, who was LBJ's press secretary, just dodged it, didn't want to admit what he was, but I got it, it's in the writing. But Sam Kinney also confirmed, yeah, he became appointment secretary to Johnson. It's also in Emory Roberts' obituary that he became appointment secretary to Johnson. This has never happened. In 1865 to 2014, the only agent this ever happened to was good old Emory Roberts, who Lyndon Johnson said in 1968 in a press conference, Emory Roberts, he greets me every morning and says goodnight to me every night. He said the exact same thing about Bobby Baker, who went to jail for him. That boy greets me every morning and says goodbye to me every night. Emory Roberts also became an inspector, a highly coveted position of power. He didn't speak to anybody other than William Manchester, didn't speak to the FBI or the Warren Commission. Again, died relatively young in 1973, one of my chief suspects because of what he did, his file, and who benefited. I mean, this is unprecedented. It's like there's one other example, only Emory Roberts. It turns out his grandson, John, worked for George W. Bush. So what even grandson, grandfather, what's he doing there? What's he still like in the corridors of power all these years later? The Roberts are there with, current sitting president at the time. And then my other major suspect, again, we're only talking a handful of people. I'm not denigrating the Secret Service. I'm a big fan of them. I'm just an ardent critic of that day. And Floyd Boring would be my third major suspect. And he was the planner of the Texas trip from the Secret Service's standpoint, meaning that from the Secret Service standpoint, he's the one who assigned agents. He was the one who was behind the nuts and bolts of all these things transpiring. So the buck stops with Floyd Boring. We want to get down and dirty about what happened. And he is the agent. It's just in the interest of time, you read chapter one of my book. He is the originator of the blame the victim story. It's all originates with him about Kennedy allegedly ordering him out the car. Well, this is another insane moment of my research, this amazing moment. When I spoke to the gentleman twice and I got him on tape, I even got him in writing, he told me President Kennedy never ordered him off the car. Oh, no, he's very cooperative, very nice man, never interfered with actions at all. He wrote me a letter saying that President Kennedy was very cooperative. He told the JFK Library, and this only came out because researcher Bill Adams and I harassed the JFK Library, released this oral history that was buried for 23 years. Floyd Boring told the JFK Library in 1976 that President Kennedy was very cooperative of us. Didn't say anything about ordering him off the car. But yet, 1963-64, there was Floyd Boring in a report blaming President Kennedy. Turns out not to be true. He tells the AARB, because I told the AARB, interview this guy, talk to him, get him on the record. They got him on audio tape. And Floyd Boring is reading Clint Hill's Warren Commission testimony where Clint Hill blames Floyd Boring for the order, allegedly, from Kennedy about getting him off the car. Floyd Boring says, oh, no. No. That was just I was just telling about President Kennedy's friendliness and kindness and consideration and not wanting us to be in the back of the car if we didn't need to be. Well, what turns out, I didn't find until years later, the only reason they weren't on the back of the car at the tail end of the Tampa trip was because they did it on their own volition, because they were moving at a fast rate of speed, like I said earlier in this presentation. They got off the car because they were moving at a very fast rate of speed and the buildings were all covered and the motorcade was essentially from a publicity standpoint. And before anybody out there thinks there's another thing out there, that there's a monkey wrench thing, I've heard Clint Hill espouse this and say, well, they just wouldn't have been on the car, in the back of the car anyway, at high rate of speed. That is not true. They were on the back of the car sometimes at 50 miles an hour or more. I have filmed clips of them in Germany where they're going 50 plus miles an hour. They're on the back of the car. Former agent Bob Lilly told me he was on the back of the car in one motorcade. They were going upwards of 50 to 60 miles an hour. It was an outdoor motorcade, obviously. The bubble top was on, no rain, and he's hanging on the back of the car for dear life, but that's what they did. They did that in later trips of other presidents when the limousine was all guarded. They still were on the back of the car. But again, they throw the blame on Kennedy, all these hogwash excuses. Oh, it's the speed of the car. Oh, Kennedy didn't want us there. We would have been there anyway. It's not true. And what it boils down to is, and we can get into more details, but just in the interest of time, I'll tell your audience, for better or for worse, you can blame me for the Gerald Blaine and Clint Hill books. Gerald Blaine and Clint Hill being former JFK agents that came out only in the last few years, 2010 to the present, with books. And Clint Hill's come out with another book, by the way. In the summer of 2005, I wrote a 22-page letter to Clint Hill, and it was basically a thumbnail sketch of all my research, all the things I'm telling you right now. Basically, was a thumbnail sketch I sent him. I got his unlisted address and phone number back in 2005. I can't stress that enough. Unlisted phone number. He was never contacted by anybody other than Mike Wallace, William Manchester, the Warren Commission. That was it. No private researcher got through to him, I should say, other than me. And it was because Lynn Meredith, an agent that has now passed away, shockingly gave me his address and said, maybe you want to talk to Clint Hill. In fact, here's his phone number. He might be a better source for you than I was. I guarded the Kennedy children. Maybe you want to speak to him about these matters. Well, I sent him this letter, and it was I wanted a signed receipt to prove that he got the letter. I got no response. I wasn't expecting one, but I called him. And he was very angry as soon as he found out with me. He goes, I have no interest in talking to you whatsoever. He was violently angry, and he hung up on me. I was like, okay, well, I thought that was where the matter rested, something interesting. But somebody would say, well, then that's not really probative. He was angry at you for saying that he left Kennedy out to dry. Well, keep in mind, Clint Hill was in his late 70s at the time. Gerald Blaine was in his late 70s at the time. When I spoke to Gerald Blaine, just coincidentally, a couple days later, Gerald Blaine's quoting from the letter I sent to Clint Hill in private. It turns out I didn't know at the time. They were friends for 50-plus years. They served in the Denver field office together. Then I'm hearing press reports that former agent Gerald Blaine's come out and spoke to Kennedy detail after he saw all of his deceit on the Internet, translation my work, because he was afraid of what I was espousing. And in his book, it's a total hanging JFK to drive, blaming the victim. It's crass. Gerald Blaine, in 2004, before his book came out, actually twice told me President Kennedy never ordered the agents off the car, was a very nice man, cooperative, joined all his many colleagues and telling me the same thing. His book is bold-faced lies telling the world the exact opposite, that JFK banned the agents from his car, that JFK didn't understand why he wanted to be so callous. He's inventing this whole meeting that never happened. He's claiming that on the day of President Kennedy's funeral, they got together and, Chief Riley said, hey, we can't blame the president for not being on the back of the car. By writing this book, the whole world knows now. And more importantly, that story has been on since 63, 64. The Warren Commission, how many people received that and saw the newspaper serials and the trans... That story has been out for decades. It was no secret. If it wasn't supposed to be a secret, it's an epic fail. But what Gerald Blaine was trying to do is get the onus off them because he realized what my letter did. My letter was basically a huge, colossal event with these gentlemen. In fact, the former Agents Association gets together once a year in different cities, and only agents are allowed, nobody from the public or the media. It's closed door. And Gerald Blaine admitted that Clint Hill got together with the director of the Secret Service twice to discuss the reason for writing the Kennedy detail. And it's like, wow, this is unbelievable. And Gerald Blaine's admitting he started writing the book in the summer of 2005. Wow, summer 2005. That's when I sent the 22-page letter to Clint Hill. Just a coincidence. When I spoke to Gerald Blaine, he was totally retired. He was fly fishing in Colorado. He had no desire to write a book. Like those guys used to wear it as a badge of honor, that we would never sell out the president. We're not into profiting from his death. Meantime, those guys have made millions, and that's no exaggeration, no hyperbole. They're on the biggest publisher. All their books have been bestsellers. They got advanced to a major movie. I don't know if it's still going to come out or not, but big-time people involved, a Discovery Channel Emmy-nominated documentary. Those guys have profited so much from their traveling all over the world, espousing that Kennedy didn't want them there. And unfortunately, some people are believing this crap. And that's why, thank God, they didn't expect my book to come out. They just thought I was going to be some guy on the Internet. Oh, this young kid who wasn't even born. Meantime, Lisa McCubbin, who co-wrote all the books, who I strongly suspect did write the book, and she was the ghostwriter, is my age. She wasn't born when the assassination happened either. But they hold it against me that, oh, he wasn't born when it happened. Meantime, hello, what about Civil War historians? We can just forget Civil War historians. Yeah, they weren't born when it happened. And, oh, World War I, you weren't born. You're no good. We got to disqualify. Oh, you weren't around during Jesus' time. Oh, yeah, you don't qualify. Were you around when Jesus was conceived? Man, it's ridiculous. You see where I'm going with it? But that's what they try to use in again, the heads rule. I've been threatened by the former Agents Association. They told me to cease and desist from contacting any more of their associates. Gerald Blaine's attorney sent me a threatening letter. They both got on C-SPAN and shockingly, out of nowhere, brought me up, played one of my YouTube videos and basically tried to denigrate me again, saying I wasn't born during the assassination and just hogwash. I responded to a video of my own. It's like a mix where I'm responding, and that's why I came out with the book. And they were shocked. They didn't realize I was coming out with the book. And then that's when they came out of the woodwork, and 90% of the reviews have been overwhelmingly positive. The 10% that are bad are all Gerald Blaine's friends. In the interest of time, I'm not going to name them. I don't really want to name them. One of them I will, though, is Chuck Zaboral, former agent. He actually wrote a one-star review of my book and goes on and on lying with his buddy Gerald Blaine to try to cover up because they realize, wait a minute, he came out with a book. Oh, geez, he's not just some guy blogging it's too late. But again, this is beautiful because at least it's out there. It's a Connor. It, just to sum it up, and we'll go into more specifics in a moment, but just to sum up for your audience, you know, we've been espousing for years and going back and forth, did Oswald do it? Was Oswald even involved? Was there a conspiracy? And it's all very important. And the public's overwhelmingly on our side. But the thing I think is tragic is the blaming of the president. The president was assassinated, then his character was assassinated. Then they assassinated his character again by blaming him for his own death by saying, oh, he didn't want these security measures. Meantime, they protected the president very well, thank you, before Dallas. He gets to Dallas, and this coincidence, his security is stripped tremendously in the wrong way, and it's just, you know, just a coincidence. We're supposed to believe this. It's one thing for, you know, Lincoln to not be guarded, or the guy walks away and, you know, gets a drink in a bar. But this is official Secret Service protection, and now, hey, these guys were drinking the night before, and they make Clint Hill out to be a hero. Meantime, he got there when the shooting was all over and done with. And for people to believe there was this one shooter, he looks even worse. But there's no conspiracy. It really was over, wasn't it? He got to the car when it was all said and done. Jackie and him never actually touched hands. Jackie got in and out of the limousine of her own volition. Clint Hill has always said the back of the head was gone. It indicates crossfire and conspiracy that the back of the head was gone. But he says Oswald acted alone. How he would know that running to the car and not seeing it. Paul Landis says shot came from the front in two of his reports. Now he's saying all these years later his report was mistaken because Gerald Blaine has massaged the memories of all these guys. Now they're trying to change their tune. Wynn Lawson came out and said the back of the head was gone in 2010. Now he's trying to say that the wound was more to the front of the head. It goes on and on. That's the war we got going. Words. It's like a Cold War, like a so to speak, between the Secret Service and myself, at least the former agents. I have a lot of people in my corner. Robert Prospero, who's the head of Reagan's details, a big fan of mine. So I've got a big, it keeps me humble. But I got people like him on my side who wrote me unsolicited, was a big fan of my book and my work. Then I have former JFK agent Larry Newman, who said some things I could not say because they're profane about me. So that keeps me humble, the two extremes. But yeah, it's a lot to digest there, but if you have any other questions, I can go into more specifics.
Yeah, your specific, your really detail here is just wonderful in trying to uncover. But you made an important point there where you said that the confusion that they're trying to promulgate and to create, it's a great deception that they try to put out to the public. Is that right? And just confuse everybody with a bunch of lies and half-truths and bending of truths and so forth. This is what you've been battling. Is that right?
Yes, and George, it's so well said. And here's the thing. Forget for a moment the assassination happened 50 and now going on 51 years ago. Forget that for a moment. Only since 2010, maybe we'll stretch it to 2005 when I wrote my letter to Clint Hill, that very recent history, the presidencies of George W. Bush and Obama still in office, just this recent time, has been these war of ideas and getting across to the public. Only recently, again, have these gentlemen, Hill and Blaine, come out of nowhere because of my letter, and I'm 100% sure it's not just my ego talking or I'm mistaken. I know for a fact this is the deal. These guys came with these books to counter what I was writing. Sure, Clint Hill's second book is a wonderful book about Jackie. If you can eliminate a couple pages where he talks about the assassination and does the old Gerald Blaine bold-faced line, that's neither here nor there. But I'm saying as far as the assassination goes, these guys have come out on MSNBC, Fox News, CNN, book tours around the country, for that matter, around the world. Clint Hill's in Greece. He's in Italy. He's in France. He's in England. And he's still out there now. He's coming out with another book, people. Yes, Clint Hill's coming out with another book. If you count the Kennedy detail, that's his fourth book now since 2010. It's coming out next year. It's going to be about his entire career because all the other books have been major bestsellers. He's made millions again. Now, Jake Gyllenhaal and his sister, I forget her name right now, are major Hollywood actors. Their father, Steven, is a little lesser-known director, Hollywood director. He's going to be the one directing this movie. Now, I'm hearing mixed reviews. I'm hearing because Parkland, the movie, did so bad that the backers backed out of the Kennedy detail. But when you go on the Internet Movie Database, it says the movie's still in post-production, so we'll see. But this movie comes out, it's going to be like JFK in a bad way. It's going to be people leaving the theater saying, hey, Martha, looks like President Kennedy didn't want the agents on the back of the car. Looks like he kind of had it coming, I hate to say it. Whether these conspiracy theories are true or not, hey, he didn't want this protection. So God damn him. You know, like blaming him for, you know, he slept around and whatnot. Meantime, I don't want to get into big digression here. But JFK, a very handsome man. Power is the offer, the ultimate aphrodisiac. If they were going after ugly Henry Kissinger, they're going to like JFK. You know what I'm saying? The women were jumping after him. It wasn't the other way. You know what I mean?
So right.
I'm not an apologist for him. I mean, I'm a big admirer of the man. Every president, every person, every human being has faults. He did love Jackie in his own way, and it got very close. By the way, the agents do defend him, even the ones who hate him for his private life, do say after the death of baby Patrick, the two became very close. He no longer was womanizing and all that. I do think some of the womanizing has been exaggerated, but that's another story for another time. The bottom line is here, we had the man brutally murdered, okay? Then we had his character assassinated. Now, in the last 4 to 5 years, we're having his character assassinated by basically blaming him for his own murder. That's what these gentlemen are doing, and it's an active thing. It's not 50 years ago. It's not Get a Life. It's not old historical hogwash. We're talking about a current event, about these old gentlemen going around the country and around the world on book tours and doing all these projects and book follow-ups and all this stuff. And it's not like these books are dying to death. They're becoming New York Times bestsellers, and they're going on Chris Matthews and Fox News of Hannity. And the spy, I can't tell how many times I've torn out my hair and heard Gerald Bland saying, yeah, President Kennedy banned us from the back of the car, and basically blaming him for the assassination. They both say Oswald acted alone. I don't think Oswald acted at all. I think he was innocent, by the way. I definitely believe, among other things, very earnest book, Girl on the Stairs, exonerates Oswald right there. He was not a shooter, but we'll get to that later on, perhaps. But that's my bottom line there. But these two old gentlemen going on lying, you know, just soiling the memory of President Kennedy, basically pissing on his grave, pardon the vernacular, and saying these things. And meantime, they're profiting. You know, the thing that really gets my goat is that, other than maybe David Lifton and a couple other very few authors, most of the people are like me. We work a day job. We're not rich, to put it mildly. We're lower middle class a lot of times. We're out there eking out of existence. And you got people like Posner, Bugliosi, David Belin, Norman Mailer, Gerald Blaine, Clint Hill, all the lone nutters are the ones who are making millions or at least hundreds of thousands or at least retired early, and they're just gallivanting around the world as far as, but the people like me and people in your audience and that are the ones, the truth tellers, and we're eking out a living and working for a living. And so I hate this stuff with the cottage industry of conspiracy that Gerald Blaine keeps throwing around. How about the cottage industry of no conspiracy? Those are the people that are really profiting, not us. And I hate the hypocrisy of all this. It just makes me want to throw up, to be honest with you. But that's where we're at now. So just drumming it in people's heads. Don't sit there and think, oh, it's 50, 51 years. It's kind of getting old, isn't it? No, it isn't. It's a current event as long as you have Gerald Blaine Clinton out there, and you need to stop right there. And these gentlemen are on there espousing their lies and making unbelievable amounts of money espousing these lies. This would be one thing if they're coming out and saying the truth. Then you could say, well, it's a shame, you know, but it's a free market, free country, hey, First Amendment rights, blah, blah, blah. But when they're desecrating his memory by saying that basically he had it coming, that's vile to me, especially for the men who were sworn to protect him and defend.
Right. We've got about 6.5 minutes left. Could you conclude with some of your summary and so forth for the last six and a half minutes, please, sir?
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. Well, then, yeah, I appreciate the time. Thank you. I will look at it this way. I will say in a summary, I mean, a couple brief ones here. You have to go no further, okay? You don't have to go back to 61, 62, or 63 if you don't want to. You can just go back to the Florida trip, and I'll compare briefly what happened in Florida that did not happen in Texas, specifically Dallas, okay? Agents rode on the rear of the limousine. Okay, and it was during the longest motorcade JFK ever had domestically. It was the second longest. Germany was the longest. In Germany, they were on the back of the car as well. And he gets to Dallas. Other than Clint Hill, very briefly, he was assigned to Jackie. No agents rode on or near the rear of the limousine. By the way, Clint Hill riding the back of the car briefly, that kind of debunks the notion that Kennedy ordered the agents off the car. Uh-oh, big mistake, and Clint Hill doesn't realize it. If he's riding briefly on Main Street, I thought Kennedy didn't want you there, pal. Uh-oh, doesn't realize it. The military aide rode in the front seat between the driver and agent in charge. The military aide said he was asked for the first time in Dallas not to ride there by the Secret Service. Press photographer's flatbed truck was in front of the limo. It was canceled at the last minute at Love Field. They usually rode at a fast speed between 25 to 40 miles an hour, sometimes 50 and 60 miles an hour. Slow as a turtle in Dallas, especially when they got to Dealey Plaza. You had either the number one or number two agent in this case, Floyd Boring, was actually on the trip. This is the first time a third stringer, Roy Kellerman, in this case, goes on a trip on his own. This would be like going to the Super Bowl and having the third stringer get off the bench. And we're going to put Tom Brady away. Who's the third string no-name guy from the college? Yeah, put him out there. We're going to start up. That's basically what this boils down to. You had multi-story rooftops guarded. Again, this is Florida, not a trip to Florida specifically. No rooftops were guarded. No windows were watched. Nothing in doubt. Multiple motorcycles ran next to JFK in a wedge formation, including, obviously, the other prior Texas stops. In Dallas, it goes from four on each side to two on each side, and the motorcycle outriders were told by the Secret Service to never pass the rear wheels. They were useless. They offered no protection whatsoever, and also less eyes and ears, professional eyes and ears, where shots could have come from, no collateral damage, less people around the car to be shot, huh? What a coincidence. The White House photographer Cecil Stoughton rode in the follow-up car taking photos. He did this on trips through July, August, September, October, November, up to the day before. He's not there in Dallas. Pierre Salinger was on the trip. You might say, what does that have to do with anything? Pierre Salinger, as an agent admitted to me, was very knowledgeable about motorcade routes, planning of trips, and so forth. Again, another third stringer went in his place. Malcolm Kilduff, this is his first major trip on his own, just like Roy Kellerman. Well, a green rookie maybe wouldn't notice changes in the motorcade route. The motorcade route was changed. See my book for more and other details that were missed because he doesn't barely know what he's doing, and he wasn't there like Pierre Salinger to know. Dr. Berkeley, the president's personal physician, was close to JFK. He protested and was put far away from the limousine. Evelyn Lincoln, Dr. Berkeley himself, even corroborated this. Police usually line the street in good number. They were there in very few numbers. They were watching the moving motorcade. They were useless. They were spectators. They weren't watching the crowd. There were no plainclothesmen in the crowds. Normally, there's plainclothesmen in the crowds. The military usually lined the routes, faced the crowd. This time, there was no military whatsoever, and they were called down the night before, if you believe Fletcher Prouty, which I do, see my book. And again, if I had to sum it up, that's where we're at right now. It's, you know, the polls are on our side. And, you know, and the books are selling, and I'm very heartened by the fact that the work in the last 5, 10, 15 years has been the best it's ever been. Since 1963, you can go back to the last few years, it's been some of the best books and best work has ever been done. But this is a current event in one respect. You have Gerald Blaine and Clinton Hill out there blaming the victim and laughing, big smiles, grin. Don't shed any tears for Clinton Hill. Oh, he's having the time of his life, drinking champagne, flying around Italy and France and making Buku De Niro. He has another book coming out next year.
Right, right. What? Yeah. Give us your website and where you can find your book.
Okay, yeah. If in the interest of your readers, rather than HTTP, they can just go to Google and just Google my name, Vince Palomara. It's always P-A-L-A-M-A-R-A. Again, Vince Palomara. And my book's called Survivor's Guilt, The Secret Service and the Failure to Protect President Kennedy. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Finder Bookstores. It's in Kindle and paperback. And it's all documented. It's not theories. It's fact. It's what these agents told me, what they wrote to me against official record. You can actually see the actual newspapers, the actual Secret Service reports. You don't have to take my word for it. I'm not just a talking head going on and on. It's actually documented. So, yeah.
Well, Vince, you're a fine person, and you've made a lot of sacrifices in bringing this to the public. And the audience, along with myself, we thank you profusely in all your hard work and your dedication to truth. And that's what our conference is about.
I really appreciate it.
And you're a fine addition to our conference here in Arlington and in the Dallas area.
Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody.
And we thank you for being with us, and good day. Thank you. You're a fine gentleman.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.